Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line we have Yukon Quest champion this year and Iditarod veteran Hugh Neff. Hugh, how's it going?
Good morning. Going great. We're actually making it into the 40s finally here in Tok. So this is, you know, sort of an interesting time of year up here in Alaska because a lot of people think that, you know, spring and summer are right around the corner. And even though the warm weather's here, we still got another at least a month or so of snow on the ground. So I'm still getting out there with the dogs and having some fun while we still can.
Well, you know, that's the topic for today. We're talking about spring training and traveling with your dogs out there on the trails. And like you said, we've probably got 3 or 4 feet of snow left here in Willow, and I'm sure you guys have quite a bit up there in Tok. And a lot of folks do put their dogs away and, you know, let them rest and get fat during the summer, but you can't do that if you're a premier Iditarod or Yukon Quest team. Tell us about that. What do you have going on these early weeks after the Iditarod and before you start your school tours and things?
Oh, I would say not only us premier rushers, I don't think any person with a dog should just put them away and say, okay, your training's done, we'll wait for next year. If you're a dog musher, if you're a person with a dog living in Chicago or New York City, you know, you should be out there every day giving your animal the exercise it deserves and the exercise that you as a human probably need. It's half the reason I got into dogs when I was a kid was I realized having dogs in my life would keep me healthy, keep me outdoors walking. And, you know, I think walking is one of the easiest things we can do as humans that none of us do enough of. So I don't care where you're listening to the show right now. If you got a dog or even if you don't have a dog, you know, get out there and enjoy the world. I guess some people are starting to call me sort of a preacher, Robert. I don't know why, but I like to throwing my 2 cents here and there.
Well, you know, this is your show. You can say whatever you want, and if you're a preacher, that's fine with me. But that is a great point, Hugh. I stress that every day when I work with clients just in regular dog training. You would be surprised how many behavior problems just with your regular pet dog that lays around the house will fix if you just take him on a half-mile walk around the neighborhood. It helps so much just on that basic energy that the dogs have, and to be able to extinguish that somewhere, it helps so much.
That's what's so funny about some of these groups, you know, that might be a little anti-dog mushing, like Peter or what have you, that if there's anybody they should be going after, it should be the people that have the over-fed, you know, out-of-shape dogs that are pretty much not living. They're slowly dying, living on couches in, you know, every other home in America right now. And it was always a dream of mine, believe it or not, before Oprah went off the air, is I wanted to go on her show and sort of talk to city people about, or, you know, city, country, wherever you live, about even Alaska, but getting out there and realizing that these just aren't animals that you own to do with as you wish. These are, you know, treasures that were given to nurture properly and to feed properly and to take care of. And if you're not, you know, giving them what they deserve, then you don't really deserve to have one. It's the way I look at it, whether it's a dog or whatever type of pet you might have. But dogs obviously need quite a bit of attention, and that's why when I, you know, like a lady friend from Fairbanks asked if I had any retired dogs that she could have as pets, and I said, sure you can, but I would prefer that you take two of them because I think dogs are social animals, and I don't think they should be alone either. I think they should always have a mate with them, a friend or what have you. So, yeah, I think that's the beauty of dogs, though. By having to take care of them, I think it brings out the best in us as humans. So, you know, I'm looking forward to once we get off the show here, I'm going to hook up a team and go on a little 10-mile run. We're still running, you know, and I'll run throughout the summer with them. I got such a young kennel, they need the attention and the, you know, the training or just the playtime. But the beauty of Tok, where we're at, is it's a thick spruce forest, and so the trail is just rock hard right now, and I've got a lot of, you know, sprint musher friends that like to fly out there, and so once I get to their section of trail, it's like being, you know, on an airstrip at an airport. It's really fast. So fun time of year. The caribou are around and lots of animals run around in the 30s usually when we're running, but no sun. And it's fun. And it's, if anything, that's the toughest part about the summer for me, is actually not being on a dog sled. I go a little loopy in the head because I miss, you know, being out there flying through the trees.
Well, Hugh, I got to bring up the point you just made a few minutes ago about Oprah. You know, she has her own network now called OWN, Oprah Winfrey Network. Maybe we can get you on there for a Gypsy Musher show. You know, Dog Whisperer has his own gig on Nat Geo. Maybe we can get you on Oprah's channel.
Oh, it's funny that you bring that up, because I used to, when I had TV, we used to watch that show, the Dog Whisperer, and I always wanted to get that dude up here to Alaska and show him that there's, you know, because he's a brilliant guy, Caesar, but he's doing city animals, you know, with bad habits that have been created by, you know, yuppie people that are not usually around enough to nurture the dog's personalities properly. So I always thought it'd be funny to get that little, you know, he's from Mexico, and it'd be great to get him up here and throw him on a dog team, because he looks like he could be a great jockey for a dog team, and it'd be interesting to see how he would look at, you know, what we do up here compared to the dogs in L.A. and what they're like.
Another great point, and if I can just toot my horn a little bit, a lot of folks say, you know, what makes you a good dog trainer? And it's spending all of those years with a pack of sled dogs that have made me a little bit better than most people, because I do understand that intricacy of the pack and how they associate with each other. And so many other dog trainers, maybe Caesar Milan included, don't understand that necessarily. They're just dealing with those city dogs that, like we said, are laying around the house. So another great point. Man, you're on fire today, Hugh. I don't know what's going on.
No, actually, I can't remember the name of the dog, but Caesar's got one of his favorite old dude dogs that it's a pit bull, I believe, that he would use to train up other dogs. But, yeah, you're right, Robert. As far as dog mushing goes, that's how – and believe me, I might have this show, and I might be all over Facebook and all that, but there are a lot of other mushers that have a lot more dog knowledge than I do. I'm still, you know, trying to catch up to their you know, level of experience. Even a kid like Dallas Seavey, he might be, 25 years old, but – compared to me, I look at him as an older dude. And Ramey Smith, whoever, those guys, you know, have been doing this since they're babies. The way I look at it, I moved to Alaska in 95, so I'm only 17 years old, the way I look at it. So a lot of people might look at me and see an old man, but I still feel like a little kid, you know, wanting to learn.
Very cool. We're going to talk a little bit more about that spring training with dogs, but let's talk about that last race. You went from the Iditarod, 975-odd miles, about a week and a half on the trail, to the Minto 90 race, which was a very short, almost sprint race for you just this last weekend, two 45-mile heats. Tell us the difference between those two with your dogs and how you thought that they did on that race.
It was a very interesting race. It was fun. It was cool when I pulled into Minto. Minto was the first race I ever did. Came in third place back in like 98, I believe, in the Minto 90, and behind George Meyer and Ramey Brooks. But the funny part about coming into Minto was the first native person I saw was my old boss who lives there now, who moved there, Curtis Earhart. So it was great to see Curtis. He's done a lot for sprint meshing, and he was a Quest official for years too. And the Earhart name is big with my kennel. You know, I used to work for his dad up in Tanana. I'm looking forward to going to see him here in a few days. Anyhow, the race was a village race. Not going to be a lot of teams. It's more for fun. It's more about community. It's about just the spirit of, you know, spring carnival and having fun. And tough this year because there were no local teams, and I was really hoping to get out there on the trail with some of the local young kids that are trying to get into it. But maybe next year, I told them that I'll bring a team and some dogs, and if they could, Lloyd Charlie can put a couple leaders in front of them, they could have some of the younger kids, you know, in their 20s or whatever, try to do the race, because it's what we're trying to do, you know, promote the sport not only for the people, you know, that are getting into it to live their dreams, but for the people that have been here all along that deserve to be out there doing Iditarod or Quest or even North American or whatever. But this year's race was just myself, and I was the youngster. It was a bunch of older guys. I'm not going to give away their ages or anything, but, you know, I came to the, you know, we were drawing times and all that to see who was going to leave first, and I was looking around the room going, I think I can maybe win this one. And then that's the beauty of dog mushing, though, in a 45-mile race. You know, it really isn't about how young you are, how you might be able to kick more. It's about the dogs. And I had four dogs had never even raced before, and they did great, and had some of the Iditarod dogs. I had to bring Walter, of course, just so I make sure I didn't get lost at all. But they did good and everything, but I couldn't even compare. I mean, the one guy had like a North American team, Darrell Krause, and he just blew everybody away like 40 minutes each day, I think. Dogs from one of the Huntingtons from Galena through Rocky Riley, who's a prestigious musher in the area there. But did good, had fun. Dr. May had a nice-looking team, too. I told him he should do the quest, and who knows, maybe he will. He's almost won the quest back in the day when I first came to Alaska, so he's a great musher. And my buddy Al Miller got a little lost going to Old Minto, which is the turnaround point. And so we were all pretty much in our own little zones there, so we could just, you know, enjoy the land. And it's called the Minto Flats, and lots of game trails, and had a moose fly in front of the team, and saw some fox and eagle, and lots of, it's like a bird sanctuary in the summertime. It's just gorgeous there. And that's half the reason we go. It's a lot of fun. Nicole came with me, and then I had my buddy John Larson and his wife Hilda showed up for the start. Drove 3 hours through a pretty bad storm just to come to the start of the race, small village of just a few hundred people, and he's got signs and everything, you know, promoting Walter and the sport, really. And that's why we call him Fan Man. He's great, and looking forward to seeing him this weekend here at the Quest. Is having a little get together Saturday night. We're all going to meet up at.
You know what's cool, Hugh? Some things never change. I know you're one of those guys that takes hard candy with you along the trail, and I saw a picture there before the start. You holding up a couple of bags of candy. Is that kind of a tradition for you in the Gypsy Musher team?
Oh, I just pulled a piece of Hall's cough drop out of my mouth as you said that. I thought you could hear me. you know me, dude. Everybody wants to call me Cat in the Hat and all that, and I totally enjoyed the persona. But realistically, you know, my hero and the person that I sort of look at my dog yard and try to envision what his dreams were about was actually, you know, Willy Wonka. And the Gene Wilder Willy Wonka, not the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka. I mean, and Gene Wilder, you know, that movie, I remember seeing that every Thanksgiving or Christmas at my aunt's or at my dad's. And just an inspirational movie for all of us about trying to create your own dreams and then using what you've done to somehow make the world better for others around you. And at heart, you know, people are wanting me to do well in these races and all that, but I think folks might have picked up by now that I'm trying to do more than just be a great dog musher. I'm, you know, trying to be a good Alaskan, really.
And I think you're doing that very well. Up there in Minto, I was looking at the pictures there that you posted on Facebook. Can you tell our listeners what that's like up there? You know, so many people that listen to these shows, they live down in, you know, New York, Chicago, Atlanta, those areas, and they're so used to having everything next door. And I saw you guys posted a picture where it was like a convenience store or whatever, a roadhouse, and it said showers and all that right there on the sign. Tell people a little bit about that, about living out there pretty much in the middle of nowhere compared to what they're used to living in the city.
Well, I used to train out in this area. I would run dogs through the old Minto and from a Murphy Dome outside of Fairbanks and do like a little 50 or 60 mile run, I believe. And so this is like going back and seeing, you know, family to me in a way. And Luke Titus gave a big speech, and Lloyd and all them were like treating me like a, you know, it was a big deal for the village for me to go there, and it meant a lot to me. I mean, just to get to the village, you got to drive about 3 hours from Fairbanks. If folks have ever seen the road, Ice Road Truckers, it's that road, and then you take a road that juts off that road to go towards Manly, and that highway is even worse. So it's real bumpy. Get up to Ptarmigan Pass, ain't many trees and lots of wind, and gorgeous views of the valleys below, but real dangerous country. Really don't want to break down in a vehicle up there. But once you get to Minto, you realize why you went there. Most native villages in Alaska aren't the wealthiest places in the world. They actually lead pretty tough lives. Being so remote, prices for everything from gas to food are just astronomical. So even though it might be like a communal shower at a hotel that everybody has to use, it's not, you know, being down in Cozumel or one of these resorts where people like to go, but you appreciate it being there just because you're out in the middle of nowhere. And that being said, showers are nice or anything, but being a naturalist, we're looking more forward to getting up to Tanana, maybe checking out some hot springs in the area in Manly and visiting with one of my fellow, I wouldn't really call him a mentor because I don't really know him super well, but a guy that I really value talking to when I see him, and that's Joey Reddington, who has had a major influence on Brent Sass's career. I mean, if you look at Sass's team in the Iditarod, all those dogs go back to Joey's line. And Joey's just like very doggy and just a great guy to talk to about not only dogs, but just, you know, his area of the woods and Manly Hot Springs there. So that's our next trail that we'll be hitting here in a couple days.
So you mentioned the Reddington name. I know that you're friends with all the folks down here in what you call Reddingtonville down here in Kinnick. Who is Joe? What is his relation to the father of the Iditarod?
Well, Joey, with two E's, is actually Joe Reddington's son. Won pretty much all the prestigious races. Used to race military dogs, you know, back in the day. And there's him, Ramey. There's a slew of Reddingtons. But I was really happy this year because Ray Reddington finally beat me. And that means a lot to me because I was afraid that Ray was going to beat me up if he didn't beat me. So, Ray, you know I love you, brother. But Ray and I have a fun relationship, and you know, I think all mushers should sort of be, you know, teasing each other about how we do in these races because we all have our turns to do well sooner or later, depending on your kennel, the age of your kennel, and how things are meshing together with the team that year. But it's been great hanging out with Ray as both of our careers have gotten better, and to see Ray doing so well. And Iditarod, I mean, if people think it was a big deal if a Mackey won Iditarod, if a Reddington wins Iditarod, it's just going to be awesome. And so I'm wishing Ray the best every year.
Cool. And you mentioned that when you headed out to Mento, it was on the ice road, truckers road, and how difficult it was on cars. And then I saw you the day before you headed up there last week, and it seemed your truck was running okay. And then the following day after the race, your truck breaks down for a pretty good clip there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. Do you really want me to relive it? Yeah, it was dark. It was getting cold. There was a rustling in the bushes outside the vehicle. No, it was just outside of Delta Junction, about an hour from Fairbanks, just rattling coming down a hill. And fortunately, we had cell phone connection, so we were able to call AAA. And after some haggling and about 3 hours of waiting around, that we finally got somebody to come out and get us and towed us back into Fairbanks. And a couple $1,000 later, you know, it's Alaska. Vehicles are tough on you. You can either be devastated by what happened or just sort of, you know, deal with it and move on. I think a lot of, and Ray mentioned this to me actually last year, is a lot of how I can do so well at not, you know, winning or anything, but doing comparatively well year in, year out, considering how much racing I do, is that I don't overstress. I think a lot of people think too much. They stress themselves out, and that can make dog mushing a nightmare. But if you realize how lucky you are to do what you do and, you know, stay focused on taking care of the dogs and enjoying, you know, what we're, you know, not too many people get to go out and play with dogs in the woods on a daily basis. So every day I remind myself that we are living the dream, and you can't take it for granted. You gotta stay humble, obviously, but you also have to realize, you know, we're all lucky to do this. It's a tough world out there, and if I have to be cheap in other parts of my life and, you know, go shopping at Salvation Army or whatever, I don't mind as long as I get to play with the dogs.
Very cool. So you mentioned at the start of the show spring training, spring traveling with your dogs, and you told us a little bit about the trails and how important that is in terms of keeping your dog exercised and focused during the spring and summer. How does that change what you've done in, say, January, February, December type training? What is different in terms of what's going on other than it being much warmer and less snow?
You're not going to go as fast, obviously, because of the heat. You have to stop a lot more and let the dogs, you know, cool down. You don't want to have any hyperthermia problems. And you have to sort of scout out where you're going. I mean, it makes no sense to be running at 2 o'clock in the afternoon through an open field when it's sunny out. A lot of it spring training for me depends on weather. But I think by, you know, who trains all the time and who I've sort of, you know, has been quite a great mentor for me the last few years is John Baker. And he's been, John's a teaser. He's native. He likes to sort of teach you but not tell you everything. You have to learn for yourself through what he's telling you. And but he's taught me, I mean, him and his crew, Team Baker, they're running dogs in the middle of summer. They're a little bit farther north, and, you know, they live in a fairly windy area. But I think if you can figure out your schedule properly, wherever you are in Alaska or in most, you know, mushing areas where people have dogs, as long as your neighbors are okay with it, you know, if you have to get up a little bit earlier in the day or run later at night, depending on if the snow, you know, you don't want to be running on a super mushy trail because of the sun. But I think by training year-round, there's just a lot, like I was saying earlier, less stress on the dogs overall because it's what they do. It's not like, oh, boy, what the heck, you know. And it's the reason why I'm doing a race like the Minto 90 with such a young dog team, knowing that I'll probably come towards, you know, won't be in the mix in racing. I'm preparing for the future. And I know that they're going to have that same Minto 90 race here next year. But next year, hopefully, I've talked with my buddy Lloyd Charlie, who runs it, and we're hoping to have it like a week or two, you know, in between the Quest and Iditarod, which would be perfect for training up a team for, you know, going to Nome as far as younger dogs. That's the main key, I think, with this spring training is younger dogs. Walter, dogs like that, he's just playing in the yard, hanging out, having fun. Well, all my training and some of these dogs I'm running pretty much every day, maybe a day or two off here and there, is Bodie, Houdini, Rocky Ruby, some of these younger two-year-olds, yearlings that need this day-in, day-out training. And by doing that, what you're doing is you're making it a lot easier to run them, because those dogs that you have problems usually taking and putting on the into the team that are going crazy and you can barely get a harness on or get booties on, those are the dogs that probably aren't being run as much. So I think by running these younger pooches every day, it takes a little bit of the stress away, and they get in a rhythm with what you're all about.
So, Hugh, we have a question here on the chat room. A lady or a guy, I don't know who it is asking, what happens to your dogs when you're on your school tours? Who takes care of them?
Allie is the handler that's been taking care of the dogs, and she does a great job. And that's the main deal, is obviously you got to have like I was saying, John had Team Baker. We have, you know, our Laughing Eyes Kennel team, and you got to have – I had Bruce and JJ came up. Obviously, Nicole's around every day, and my buddy Jaime was here for the Quest, and Tamara helped out when we were in Nome, and there's just a big slew of people that are part of the team, and they're doing it because they want to play with dogs. And you can imagine Ellie has a pretty good job where she gets to, you know, feed and play with dogs every day, and she's got some beautiful puppies to play with too that we just had about 2 weeks ago from it's a dog that I bought from Joe Garney, and then the father is Sport, who's a John Baker dog. So I'm interested in having a little bit of a change over in the kennel over the next year or two, where I'm going towards a more coastal style husky dog. And I don't know if this is going to help out or do anything with, you know, what place they come in differently in these races, but I enjoy the husky dogs. For me, there's a difference between dog racing and dog mushing, and that's why I'm particularly not really too into sprint mushing anymore, because those are just all hound dogs to me. And I came to Alaska because I want to run huskies. And so I when I got to the coast and I saw the type of dogs that John has, and he giggles when I tell him this, but I don't even look at these dogs as huskies. I look at them as, I call them beasts, and they look like, you know, almost part wolf or something. They're just gorgeous animals. And I'm looking for a dog that's going to get you through a storm. And it seems like the husky has more of a mentality, a bond with their musher, I believe. And not to say that hound dogs, you know, aren't smart and all that, but I prefer huskies in the long run.
And that makes that connection to that old school type mushing. Those hound mixes have been in the last 20 years or so really come to the forefront. And that's a great question. If we could spend a second or two on that, when that transferred over, I don't know if that was before your time or after.
It started with Martin Boozer as far as long distance goes. If you watch any of the old Iditarod videos, Susan and I don't know who else, but you could tell that Martin, they were talking down his dogs, and he didn't really care for that. Maybe that's why he's got sort of an edge to when he races, and he has to prove to everybody how his dogs are, you know, how talented they are. But obviously, Martin has had an incredible effect on the whole sport as far as the hound mix in long distance. Now it's predominant, and you don't see as many husky teams anymore. They're still husky in the dogs, but there's definitely you can notice the hound as well. And that's my kennels too. You know, it's not other people. I mean, look at Annie and that whole litter. They don't have a thick fur to them. They're a thinner furred dog.
And you mentioned John Baker living out there on the coast and the difference in the dogs obviously evolving over there compared to even down here in the valley and over your area. How much do you think that goes into play in terms of breeding for those dogs, just for the survival, not necessarily for running, but the survival of that type of dog versus that hound type dog we're talking about?
Well, and that's part of it. I think the huskier dog is more... it's adaptable to the environment. It can handle the wind or the snow or the cold. I have sprint musher friends that keep their whole dog teams inside because of their lack of fur. And so, and I've done that as well in the past. You know, if it's weather gets tough, you put your dogs in a barn or what have you. I've also been to kennels where the dogs have such thick fur that dog can never even go inside. It'd overheat right away. You have to find a nice mix. I've been to, you know, Eskimo kennels where the guy didn't even have dog houses, and the dogs were beautiful. I mean, just gorgeous, thick, luscious fur, really with a shine to it, you know, and thick meat on their bodies. Just gorgeous animals, and that's, for me, what it's all about. Is that's what we should all be about, not winning races, about perfecting our talents as, you know, dog people, and that's... I still got a lot to learn, because it's about finding the right mix and what's going to adapt to your style. So that's why I think I'm going towards this more of a husky, slower type dog that can go farther, because I don't know if sprint dogs and the Huneff style of doing long runs really mix well together.
A great point, and I know John Baker has said that. That's why he won last year, was because of his running style with those bigger, furrier dogs compared to a lot of the sprint dogs that sprint type dogs, the hound dogs that you mentioned in years past. Because I know Dallas Seavey, he has a lot of those sprint type hound dogs, and of course a different style of running, and of course a different race this year in how he won with his dog team. So another great point. Hugh, we have about 15 minutes left. I definitely want to talk about the dog of the week. What else do you want to mention about that spring training, spring traveling with your dogs?
It's warmer, but it can be dangerous. There's overflow out there and stuff like that, and there's animals out there too that you have to start worrying about here, bears and stuff like that pretty soon. So make sure you have protection with you if you're up here in the north in Alaska, and enjoy it. It's a great time of year. Lights have been out lately here in Turok, the auroras, so I look forward to getting up there and visiting friends, and it's just experience for the dogs, getting in the truck, being on the road, and don't let a day go to waste, because, you know, sooner or later here it's going to be all dust and tourists and bugs within a couple of weeks. So I love the springtime. I think it's one of my favorite times in Alaska.
Very cool. So in the next couple of weeks, you're heading, you said you're heading to Tanana, then you're heading to Hawaii, then you're heading on your school tour. And you said you'll have about a month left of snow and training and whatnot. What happens in the summer there at Laughing Eyes Kennel? Do you use primarily ATV? What do you use up there?
Yeah, right now I'm in the process of trying to switch homes, so I'm dealing with that. But in this area, I love this new spot that I've been using this winter, because it's just thick trees, and yeah, it's four wheelers, Been talking with some local businesses about getting some tourism attraction going here. Nothing too big. I'm not really into using dogs to make money. I'm into showing off my dogs to the world. And I think it'd be fun to have visitors come and hang out and maybe meet some of the dogs and pet them and stuff like that. But I'm not necessarily going to be doing much, you know, runs in the summer. I run according to the dog schedule more than anything. This is going to be a very busy summer, obviously, because of what happened with the Quest and all that. But I look forward to it. People, when I do my school tours, obviously the Iditarod has a bigger name in the U.S. The Quest, I believe, has a bigger name internationally. And I talk about both as much as I can. I promote myself, too, but I just, for years now, I've been trying to educate people about what the Quest is all about, because I think it's an undervalued race. And even though I might not have a be in the Quest race next year, I'll probably be in Uniqlo race in that race, Mitty Johnson's race, I will have a team in the Quest, just because I believe that if you're a true Quest musher in it for the long haul, look what Sebastian's been doing. Just because you can't be in the race doesn't mean you can't support the race and somehow get out there and, either give somebody else a team to use or, you know, get out there, take pictures, whatever you're going to do. Find a way to support your race, and not just by telling everybody how the race should be run, but getting out there and doing something to help the race grow. That's really what we should all be trying to do.
And I know you mentioned in your last show you're heading over to Germany and Australia as well in the off season. Can you share a little bit about that? I know we'll talk about this as it comes up, but when is that happening, and what's the plan when you're over there?
Well, I'm going to be, believe it or not, a race marshal in Australia, and I'm looking forward to it. And from all of my Facebook Australian friends, they're really looking forward to it. I've been having people contact me from all over. We were just looking earlier today at some pictures on the net of some kart racing they're doing in some dunes there. And it's probably not all going to be on snow. There is snow in parts of Australia, I heard, but usually they're running with carts. And I want to run a team. I want to see what it's like up there. And it's always fun to hang out with mushing people wherever they are in the world. Germany, that's just something we're still throwing together. I've got a lot of friends that I met through the Quest this year. I think for the Quest to grow, and hopefully somebody within the Quest is doing something about this, they need to get Germany more involved. Germany used to be a big part of the Quest, and financially, the history of the Quest could have been much different, I believe, if German companies had somehow been integrated into the Quest a little bit in a different way than they were. And unfortunately, things didn't go the right way as far as financially for the Quest in that respect, but I don't think it's too late, and I think we as mushers need to get out there and promote this race. And every year, dozens of German people fly to the Yukon or to Fairbanks just to follow the Yukon Quest. It's a big deal to them. And so I think we as mushers, and I know Sebastian and other mushers, Sepp Herrmann, and other German mushers have gone back to Germany and done, you know, slideshows and promoted the race, and that's great. And that's what this the Quest needs is financial help, you know, as well as the Iditarod. But I think the Quest is in a little bit more dire straits, and we need to protect, you know, something that's good not only for mushers, but I think for the Alaskan spirit. I think people really enjoy following these races in the middle of the winter when it's dark out and cold, and they live vicariously through what we're doing out there on the trail.
That's a good point. You talked about Germany and the Quest, and that's come up about the Iditarod, and of course the financial constraints of it. As an ambassador for the Quest, of course, you being the champion this year, you know, a lot of people think about that, and you know, even in the lower 48 here, is why would I promote or give my money to a race that's so far away? You know, how can that help me as a small business owner that's in Texas or Germany or wherever? How can that help us?
If they can tie it into their cause or their program or their product that we could possibly use on the trail out there, I definitely think we as mushers, and that might be part of the problem, we're always scrounging, trying to find sponsors, people to support our kennels. And if you look at the old days, you know, when these races were started, the guy that was out there trying to scrounge money was the guy that was racing too, you know, Joe Reddington. And we as mushers, if we want this sport to grow. You know, there are corporate offices now, and those folks are doing their best to line up, you know, major sponsors. But I think we need to get out there and promote these races, because I think it personally that it's sort of embarrassing how small the payouts are for mushers in these races, considering what we go through on a yearly basis. And, you know, we're pretty much risking our lifestyles, our livelihoods, for $5,000 or $10,000 or what have you, if you come in like seventh or eighth place, you know. And to me, that doesn't seem right. And I've had many talks with many famous mushers about this, and a lot of these races, you know, because of the economy, or like you were saying, why would a sponsor want to do this? I think a lot of it has to do with what the different race organizations are going to be giving to those sponsors for their involvement. So I think possibly finding race packages where sponsors are flown up to the race and treated like, you know, royalty might be the way to go. But definitely it's time for, you know, all of the people involved, whether it's sprint mushing or long distance, to figure out ways to keep the races going. And I personally think that the Canadian government gives a lot of money for tourism for the Yukon Quest, because the Quest does great at bringing in tourist dollars. And for me, I don't understand why the Alaskan government has not been more involved, considering Alaska is the state sport. And for me, I don't understand why the governor on down isn't promoting Iditarod or any of our dog mushing with more ferocity for what it promotes, you know, throughout the, you know, the rest of the country, where it's a unique little treasure we have here called dog mushing. They might have it in other parts of the country, but they don't have it like we do up here. And I think it's a way for us to show off what we're all about.
Very cool. So about 8 minutes left, Hugh, let's talk about your old dog who has since passed away, but I'm assuming it has been an inspiration to you. He or she is named Daya, right?
Yeah, so I shortened the name. Seth Daya is actually a mountain that sits just to the north of the village of Minto, where I just raced in. So I had a little girl that I named Daya, and she's passed away a few years ago. But when I first got Daya was back in 96, 97. And I was leaving the village of Minto and mushing back to where I was living up on Murphy Dome. And got a couple miles from the village, and I looked back, and there was this little black, funny-looking, you know, I didn't really know what it was at the time. I thought it was a porcupine or something. But it was running right at the team. And then I stopped, and there was a little black Labrador mixed puppy running up to me. And I picked her up, put Day on the sled, and when I got home, before I got home, I stopped in Old Minto and gave my buddy Lloyd a call, and he said, well, you better keep her. She must love you. And I had Daya for a dozen years after that. And she was a special little girl. She was my moose dog, sort of just a village mixed dog, a little bit wild. She never really wanted to pull if I ever put her in the team, but she would go on every run with me. Even if I went on two 35, 40-mile runs in a day with two different teams, she'd go on both of them, loose. And she would run up in front of the team or be all over the place in the trees, basically scaring off any wildlife that might be in the area. Many times when I had to go out in the trees and get her in the summertime, she would have a moose cornered and be yapping at it. But she's a special girl. One time I actually had her fly by the team barking away when I was living up in Coldfoot, and I thought she was going after a moose, and I actually turned around, and she was being chased by a wolf that actually the wolf had rabies and it was dying. But anyhow, I actually had to grab her, put her in the sled, turn the team around and boogie back to Coldfoot, because I was afraid that wolf was going to, you know, try to eat her. And the amazing part about that story was on the way back to Coldfoot, I had that team flying, you know, doing 20-plus miles an hour, and that wolf basically caught us like we weren't even moving. And the beauty of Alaska is you realize it's pretty awesome being a dog musher, but compared to a lot of wildlife, we're pretty slow. But the thing that saved me on that trip was there's a little open stream of water, and I cut over the stream, and the wolf stayed on the other side of the stream. But I did stop the sled, and I rummaged through my bag, and I grabbed a camera, and I took a picture of that wolf, because not too many humans get chased by wolves. And that was one of those stories, you know, and that's what we're really all about as Alaskans. It ain't about trophies or prize money. It's about having the good stories. And that's what, if I ever get together with Lance or Ray Reddington or whoever, we're always trying to outstory each other, because that's sort of our way of showing off our testosterone.
That's cool. That's a great quote. I think we'll use that for the intro of the show. It's not about trophies or prize money. It's about the stories. I love that. So, Hugh, we're getting ready to close here. Any parting words before we go?
Just letting people know I'm pretty fairly booked up on my school talks in May. I have a couple open spots still in the South, generally speaking, in the South Carolina, North Carolina area. But if any teachers are interested, laughingeyeskennel@hotmail.com, no matter where you're at. And sooner or later, I'll make it to your school, because I love talking about dogs and I love showing off Alaska.
Very cool. Very cool. And definitely check out his website, gypsymusher.com. You can listen to us, all of his past shows. And you'd be surprised, Hugh, at who goes in and listens to this show, and then they backtrack and they listen to all the other shows as they're sitting there. I don't know who has that kind of time to sit around and listen to 6, 7, 8 hours of the Gypsy Musher, but people are doing it. So obviously you're a very engaging fellow, if I may say so.
Yeah, boy. Sometimes I could barely even listen to myself talk. I wonder how people could do that for 8 hours.
I guess,
but hey, you know, I do talk a lot, and we all know that, and I'm smart enough to learn to laugh at myself, but, you know, I'm doing this for a reason, and hopefully through my adventures, people are learning how to prepare for theirs better.
Very cool. Very cool. So we'll talk next time, hopefully next week. When is it that you're heading to Hawaii, Hugh?
Oh, that's not for another until middle of April. So I'm here for a while running dogs, and that's the way I want it.
There you go. So this is Robert Forto on behalf of the Gypsy Musher. We'll definitely talk soon, and check out Hugh's brand new Facebook fan page, the official fan page of Hugh Neff. It's just check Hugh Neff Gypsy Musher on Facebook, and you'll pull up to his page. It has his Laughing Eyes Kennel logo right there. I believe that it's still there. So check that out, because pretty soon he'll spend a lot of time there with pictures, videos, these shows, and everything else. Hugh, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
All right, Doctor. You have a good one.
Take care. We'll talk to you guys soon. Goodbye.